In the absence of Commissioner Stein, I'd like to call this meeting to order. So if you could please review the agenda. And could I have a motion to adopt the agenda? Okay, motion and second. Okay, is there any discussion? Okay, those in favor signify by saying yay.
Yay.
Opposed? Okay, motion carries. All right, the next item of business is the approval of the minutes that are in your packet. Are there any questions or issues that you'd like to raise on the minutes?
Madam Chair, I'll move approval as distributed.
Thank you. Second? Mr. Riddle? Okay.
Was it? I think it was Mr. Jensen.
Mr. Jensen? Okay, thank you. All right. Any other discussion? Okay. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? All right. Ms. Olson, can you please provide the legal report?
And it's not Ms. Wilson. It's actually I'm Ann Cohen from the Minnesota Attorney General's Office, and I am sitting in for Ms. Olson today. And I do have a number of items today for the legal report. The main item is that yesterday there was a decision rendered at the Minnesota Court of Appeals in a matter involving the agency. It was a reported decision. And I do have copies of the decision here for any board member who might want to look at the decision. So this was actually a very interesting case. I can say that because I handled it. So I know just how interesting it was. It arose out of a practice that was going on in Pope County, Minnesota, near the town of Villard, by a farm known as Reichman Land and Cattle LLP. And Reichman Land and Cattle LLP used fields on which it grew crops in the summer to house and feed cattle during the winter. And Reichman had engaged in this practice over a number of years, and the Pollution Control Agency had been engaging with Reichman over whether this practice should be permitted also for a number of years, and it was a very contentious situation. The numbers of cattle involved ranged from 2,000 to 3,500 head of cattle of various descriptions. Some of them were feeders where they were growing the cattle for market. Some of them were finishers, etc. At any rate, after this controversy had simmered for a number of years, the agency made a decision, the feedlot enforcement staff made a decision to essentially called the question and issued a administrative order to Reichman, requiring Reichman to get a permit for this practice. Now, Reichman had resisted getting a permit for this practice on the grounds that it met a state statutory definition of pasture. And Reichman also had resisted getting a permit for this practice, which is called winter feeding, on the grounds that the federal definition of an animal feeding operation did not apply to winter feeding because Reichman grows crops on this field in the summer during the growing season. And the phrase "the growing season" is used in the definition of animal feeding operation in such a way to allow an argument that if you grow crops on a field used for cattle feeding during the growing season, it's not going to be an animal feeding operation despite the number of cattle and despite the fact that the cattle are there more than 45 days, which is part of the federal definition of an animal feeding operation. So thus the issues were joined, and Reichman asked for a hearing at the Office of Administrative Hearings, which the agency granted. So there was a five-day hearing held before Judge Richard Lewis at the Office of Administrative Hearings. Judge Lewis issued his recommendation after that hearing in favor of this agency's interpretation of the pasture definition and in favor of this agency's interpretation of animal feeding operation, which this agency held that a federal permit was required, that the federal definition was ambiguous, and if you look at the preamble that EPA had adopted contemporaneously with the promulgation of that rule, it was quite clear, and it was quite clear, that EPA did not intend, in a case of a winter feedlot, for the normal growing season language to be applied. They said this definition needs to be applied at the time the animals are present. So Reichman appealed this decision to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals issued its ruling yesterday. The decision, I think, can be viewed as a victory for the agency insofar as the court ruled that Reichman's operation did not meet the state definition of pasture because the animals were not allowed to forage on the fields but were instead being fed. But the Court of Appeals also ruled with one strong dissent that a federal animal feeding operation permit was not required. So it was sort of a split the baby outcome. But the upshot of this decision for the agency, I think, is that at least for this state, this type of winter feeding operation will be prohibited as being an unpermitted feedlot if the concentration of animals is such that the animals are not actually foraging on vegetative residue that's left on the fields but are instead being fed. And this would be a very helpful decision as far as the state is concerned because there are a number of cases that are pending right now where this issue will likely arise. And so it is a very beneficial decision in that sense for the state. I think EPA may very well be concerned about the decision because the Court of Appeals refused to look at the preamble language that EPA had published suggesting how it wanted the definition to be interpreted. The court said, nope, we're not going to look at that. We're just going to go with what we see as the plain language of the law, and we're going to hold that no federal permit is required for this type of animal feeding operation. And so from a perspective of the National Clean Water Act program that EPA administers, this decision will likely be of some concern to the EPA. Are there any questions that I can answer about this? Would anybody like a copy of the decision? Okay.
Oh, you have it right there?
I do.
Sure.
Oh, great. Okay. Perfect. Yeah.
I would like one too.
Sure.
Please.
Oh, well. And we'll just pass them along. Anyway, it will be, we will have to wait and see whether Reichman Land and Cattle appeals this decision. So they will have a number of days, 30 days, to determine whether they would like to ask the Minnesota Supreme Court to review this decision. The Supreme Court does not have to review this decision. Supreme Court reviews cases on a discretionary basis if they find the case to be of statewide or some other reason why it's important for them to review it. So we will not know whether the Supreme Court will take the case or not. So that will be something we'll just have to wait and see what happens. As far as some other cases are concerned, we have had a number of favorable outcomes in some other proceedings, some of which were to enforce administrative penalty orders issued by the agency. So Max Kiley handled a number of different matters in that were either settled in court or the court issued contempt orders that required regulated parties to comply with administrative penalty orders that the commissioner had issued. And so you may hear a little bit about these decisions. There is one involving a large pile of waste tires where the regulated party has agreed to clean them up. We'll see if that happens. There was another case that was involving septic system noncompliance, and that one was resolved by connecting the regulated party agreeing to connect to the city sewer system. And then there was a waste-burning case, also that was settled in the court, and the regulated party has agreed no longer to burn the waste, and et cetera. So great deal of success in that regard for Mr. Kiley. And then I also had two matters, both of which were pending at the Office of Administrative Hearings, one of which involved a company called Albert Lee Trailer. That matter was settled. This was actually not an administrative penalty order, but just a regular administrative order that had been appealed to the OAH. And that matter was settled for $20,000. And there was another SSTS matter, which was also settled at the Office of Administrative Hearings. So we've had a great number of settlements over the past month or so. Anybody has any questions about those? I'd be happy to answer them.
Yeah, not a question about those, but as I thought more about the previous one, does that operation have or need to have a state permit?
Yes, there is a state permit required for animal feedlots, and there's also a federal permit required for animal feedlots. It's a pants and suspenders system. The board may remember the rulemaking matter that was in front of the board last month. And one of the major attacks against the rule that the agency was amending in that case was from the industry arguing that the state permit, the state feedlot permit, was not required. And the agency prevailed in that argument in the rule, which is a good thing, because obviously with this decision, the state permit is going to become the key document. Given that the Court of Appeals has decided that the federal permit would not be required. If there are no further questions, that concludes the legal report.
We have the Commissioner's report. Deputy Commissioner Beeman will provide the report on behalf of Commissioner Stein.
Thank you. Good morning. Yes, the commissioner is unable to be here because actually today he is in Washington, D.C. I was invited to speak with several people coming from Minnesota at the National Academy of Sciences at a roundtable on science and technology for sustainability. And as I understand it, the particular interest that they had in this group from Minnesota is speaking about how Minnesota often works in collaborative forums on challenging sort of sticky environmental issues. And so there would be people from industry and environmental groups and government. So it was a three-way discussion about things like the Environmental Initiative and other places where we convene meetings and chew through some tough issues for policy recommendation. And so he is speaking there today, so he could not be at the board meeting. He did ask me to report on a few matters. As you know, it's the end of the legislative session, and we will plan to have our Assistant Commissioner Kirk Kudelka speak next month with a fuller report on what came out of the session in terms of legislation. But a few of the highlights we wanted to give. Clearly, this, as everyone saw, this is the unsession for the governor, and there were a number of things that were passed as part of that in terms of regulatory efficiency and enforcement streamlining. For us, one of the things, permit efficiency, has been very prominent. And there are now two tiers of permits. There's a 90-day goal for a number of our permits to be issued and a 150-day goal, for those more challenging, complex permits. But the two-tier system was new in the bills or the law that was passed this year. We also had an increase of the amount that an administrative penalty order could be assessed for, which would give us a little more flexibility in resolving some of our compliance enforcement matters a little more quickly than going through a more elaborate negotiation for a stipulated agreement. There's also, in the supplemental budget, there were a couple things. The Superfund program, as we've talked about, has had some increasing challenges around things like vapor intrusion and some other things in the Superfund area. So we did receive some additional money, just over $1 million, in one-time funding to help our Superfund program with some of the additional costs, both for the actual cleanup as well as some staffing costs. $4 million in additional SCORE funding that goes to local governments for recycling programs. That was well received, I believe, by counties in particular. Becker County, in the bonding, we have $2.62 million for a recycling facility up in Becker County. That was the main bonding item that was in the PCA's section of that bill. There is some additional funding, $104,000, for railroad emergency preparedness, and this is coming out of the discussions about the increased oil transport on railroads and the trying to build some capacity, additional capacity for emergency spill and firefighting prevention. And so this money would come to the PCA for our emergency response work to help, again, work with local government, particularly volunteer responders on, and also some of the inspections and dealing with the railroads for emergency preparedness. The LCCMR bill, which is the funding that comes through the lottery, we did receive $743,000 to work on a project to ID causes of particularly high mercury in fish. That's, again, been an ongoing challenge, and this study money is directed to, in particular, studying the Roseau River and, I believe, two tributaries of the Red River in an area that we've seen high amounts of mercury in fish. That's a multi-year study, so funding for that. A couple of the other policy bills to note before Kirk speaks more next month. Mandatory commercial recycling. That was big. As you know, we are very active in pushing on the recycling goals. The metropolitan regional recycling goal was expanded to include this now commercial recycling, which is for both things like apartment buildings, but also businesses that have a certain volume of trash being hauled. That is now included in that 75% recycling goal by the year 2030. But that's clearly going to go a long way in terms of getting that recycling rate up. We've sort of plateaued when it comes to residential recycling, but this will be very important to getting in those commercial areas as well. Those were the main highlights we wanted to hit from session. Any questions on that before I talk about a couple other things? Okay. The next thing is we had a visit yesterday, actually, from the EPA, the Federal EPA Inspector General. And the Inspector General's office is a separate but related office within EPA that does auditing and looks at fraud, waste, and abuse within the federal agency. And the Inspector General came and met with our senior leadership team and mostly was curious to hear just what were some of the policy and relationship issues between us and the EPA, particularly Region 5 within which we work. As a delegated state with a number of programs, the Inspector General was interested in how those programmatic relationships are working, and we met for over 2 hours, and it was a very good and wide-ranging conversation. Air, water, and land issues, climate change, things like that. And so we're not sure what comes of it. It was more of a fact-finding, information-gathering visit from the Inspector General, but he doesn't often get out into the state, so we were pleased that he chose Minnesota to come and visit with us for a couple hours. It's a kind of a good time for EPA. We also have the EPA Administrator, Gina McCarthy, who will be coming to the region, to St. Paul and, I believe, Burnsville on the 28th, so next Wednesday. And the commissioner will have an opportunity to meet with her and, I believe, be part of we're not quite sure exactly the logistics yet, but be involved when she's in St. Paul. The city Mayor Coleman has invited her to speak at a gathering within St. Paul, and the commissioner, we believe, will be also there. I think the governor is out of town. Otherwise, that would have been an interesting opportunity for the two of them to meet, but I believe the governor will be in southern Minnesota. Couple other things for the commissioner's activities. He will be speaking on the Thursday, the 29th, so I guess that would be next Thursday, at the Green Chemistry and Commerce Council, known as the GC3. It's an innovators roundtable. It's going to be held at 3M. And I don't know much more than that, but green chemistry is certainly something that the commissioner feels very strongly about, so be looking forward. He can probably report back at the June meeting on the outcome of that. We wanted to note that the Group Environmental Initiative will have its annual awards Thursday, the 22nd. And one of the projects that we're involved with as a large team effort, the St. Louis River Area of Concern, that's the remediation site up in the St. Louis River, that planning team has been nominated for one of the awards that EI is giving out. There's a host of very, very good environmental projects. They have five different categories that they issue awards. So we will be attending, a couple of us will be attending that dinner, and they announce the winner at the dinner. So we will see. And finally, the last thing is the EPA will be coming out with a couple rules shortly that we're keeping a close eye on. On June 2nd, what's known as the Rule 111D rules will be announced by EPA, and that'll be highly watched. Those are the rules related to greenhouse gas emissions and reductions in power plants, particularly from coal-burning power plants. So we'll be keeping an eye on that. We'll have to see from that point what sort of state implementation plan might be required, depending on what the rule says. They've not revealed much ahead of time as to what's actually in the rule, but that will be important to watch. And the other rule that we're keeping an eye on is waters of the United States, and further trying to define what the scope of jurisdiction is over waters of the United States. I don't have a timeline. I think they're just starting to take more public comment on some of that. But obviously that intersects very much with many of our rules and programs, so we'll be keeping an eye on the definition of the waters of the U.S. as EPA unrolls that. And I think that's the extent of the commissioner's report.
Great. Are there any other questions for Deputy Commissioner Beeman? Okay. Hearing none. All right. Are there any items that board members would like to raise?
And how it affects us as an agency and as a state.
I'd be happy to talk to the commissioner, but figure out what sort of presentation we could do. Is there a particular topic or just the range of higher profile?
You know, the recent Supreme Court activity related to air quality and cross-state pollution transmission, et cetera. I think we should understand more of the implication of those rulings, and now with the 111D greenhouse gas stuff, how that's going to affect our aspect as a delegated state.
Absolutely. We will add that to an upcoming meeting. Thank you.
Commissioner Riddle.
Yeah, well, not directly related to MPCA, but two items just for information. I think today's the day that opens for candidate filing, and I currently am an elected supervisor of the Soil and Water District, Winona County, and am not filing for re-election. Made that decision last fall with some of my wife's health issues, and you got to prioritize and let go of a few things, and so that's one of the things that I am not going to continue, and it's probably in the Winona paper today, so I thought I'd mention that. Last month I mentioned that I was traveling to Iran, and I have been there and back, and it's an incredible country. Very ancient culture, but yet modern and bustling. And even though it's an Islamic republic since the revolution, it's a very secular society. And, you know, I had read and been told that, for instance, you know, women can't go out on the street without their husband, father, or brother. And that's not true at all. Not at all. And I expected during the conference, you know, that there would be a call to prayer. And how would this work for a day-long conference? Well, people live secular lives. And just like here, there are people who are, you know, devout in their religious beliefs and practice, but most people are just living their lives. And the conference that I spoke at was attended by about 600 people, organic agriculture. The vice president of Iran spoke. There was lots of media attention. I was the only American. I was the only American in the country that I saw, we're losing out, basically. And, this is Persia. It's not an Arabic country. It's Persian. and very different culture, highly educated, and bustling activities in the markets and the restaurants. And there's about 3,000 organic farmers in the country. There's a Center for Excellence in Organic Agriculture within the Ministry of Agriculture. There's professors in agroecology and organic farming at Tehran University, and lots of graduate students. And so it just was really eye-opening and quite an honor to be invited there, and got to see a number of cultural and historic sites, including the Shah's former palace, which is now a public museum. And the organization that hosted this, the Iran Organic Association, is part of the Chamber of Commerce, which we would not see in this country, an organic organization being part of the chamber. And the conference was held downtown Tehran, a 12-story building of the chamber, but looking out the window was the former U.S. Embassy compound, which has its own historic significance that people pointed out to me as well. But I do intend to do some, I got lots of slides and do some presentations in the Winona area in the future. But I wanted to report that I made it. I'm back and really enlightened about the people and culture, history of Iran. I do have the proceedings from the conference I can pass around, and you see the beautiful logo that was everywhere on the building, and you can take a look at that. But very generous, hospitable people as well. So thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Riddle.
Yeah, well, the crops are very different, except wheat. This is the birthplace of wheat, and they still grow a lot of wheat. But the main organic crops that they're doing are some specialty things of that climate, like tea, pistachios, figs, rose for rose water. There's rose water ice creams. Standards themselves have not yet been translated into English, but they're based on the Codex guidelines, and I was part of the U.S. delegation to Codex and very familiar with those, and they do match up quite well with the U.S. regulations. And there are farms and processing facilities being certified by European certification bodies that are accredited by USDA. So you'll actually see the USDA organic seal on products in Iran. And the dollar is commonly accepted, which is so ironic when we don't have relations.
Okay. Are there any other board items? Okay. Hearing none. Okay, we can move on to information items. First off, if there's anyone in the audience who would like to speak on these items, please fill out one of the green forms and give it to the board administrator. Please remember that your comments should be pertain to any new information that is presented. All right. Well, today we're going to have an update on Clean Air Minnesota, an overview of the background of Clean Air Minnesota, and an update on the group's recent activities. Provided by our presenter will be Brian Timmerson. Thank you, Brian.
Madam Chair, members of the board, thank you. My name is Brian Timmerson. I know on the agenda it says Rick Patro as well, but I'll be giving the presentation today. I'm a supervisor in the Resource Management and Assistance Division of the Pollution Control Agency, and I'd like to give you an update on the most recent activities of Clean Air Minnesota. Clean Air Minnesota was founded through the joint effort of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, and the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. The goal of the group is to reduce air pollution and protect human health and meet the federal air quality standards. It's important to know that this is a public-private partnership, and it's intended to reduce non-point air pollution through voluntary programs, so it's a non-regulatory program. Today, I'd like to give you an update on the recent activities of Clean Air Minnesota, but I'd first like to provide you with a background as to why we need this public-private partnership and the sources of pollution we're addressing. So, non-point air pollution is what this group is dealing with, and non-point air pollution comes from cars, semi-trucks, lawnmowers, boats, ATVs, backyard fires, your home furnace, any source that's not regulated through an air permit. We're interested in these sources because of the fine particles and volatile organic compounds that they emit. These sources make up the majority of the air pollution that we see throughout the state. As you see by this chart, what we describe as non-point sources make up about three-quarters of the total air pollution. If you look, the non-permitted sources in dark brown, that's residential and commercial, that's about a quarter. Off-road vehicles and on-road vehicles make up about a half. And then the point sources, the permitted sources that we're used to dealing with, make up just a little over a quarter of the pollution. Our permitting process regulates those point sources, but we currently have no permitting authority to regulate the residential, commercial, and on- and off-road vehicles. Because we can't regulate these sources, we need to have this public-private partnership to address them through voluntary programs. Why is this important that we regulate these sources? The EPA is expected to lower the national ambient air quality standards, and if you look at this chart, it shows that the brown bars are where we're currently at, and it's below the red line, which is the federal standard. Now, the EPA is likely to revise this standard in the range in the blue shaded area. And if the EPA does go into that range, much of that range is in what we would call, we would be in non-attainment, or we would not be meeting the federal standards. Currently, we're below the federal standard. If the federal standard goes lower, we would have areas that would be violating the federal standard. If that standard is lowered, which we expect it to be lowered, this could cost Minnesota businesses and citizens up to $350 million annually to meet these new standards. This is why we have an active role in Clean Air Minnesota, and it is also why that we have the cooperation of our other public and private partners, because they would need to meet these new lower standards as well. So, a little bit of background in Clean Air Minnesota. Clean Air Minnesota started back in 2003 as a joint effort between the MPCA, the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy to protect human health and remain in compliance with the federal clean air standards. The membership has stayed basically the same, although the representation from the agencies has fluctuated throughout the years, but it's made up of state agencies such as the MPCA, the Department of Health. It's made up of cities like the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, Hennepin and Ramsey counties. But it's also made up of businesses such as Flint Hills, Xcel Energy, 3M, just to name a few. And it has members from environmental groups such as the Isaac Walton League, the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, Environmental Initiative, and the Sierra Club. And there's other members as well, but that's just several of the noteworthy groups. And we do have representation from health partners as well because of the health aspect of the air quality that we're dealing with. This group first started working on several projects. One of them notably is Project Green Fleet. Project Green Fleet was intended to retrofit school buses to meet the new lower emission standards. Some of the school buses were quite old and had dirtier engines. It's important to note at this time that almost all of the school buses in Minnesota have been retrofitted with pollution control equipment. We don't really know of any other state that's in attainment with the federal standards, that's below the federal standards, that has this high a percentage of school buses retrofitted. If you take the amount of pollution that's reduced from Project Green Fleet and the amount of pollution that we've reduced through our other diesel programs, it's equivalent to reducing or removing about 750,000 cars off the road. Considering there's about 5 to 6 million cars on the road, that's a very significant percentage of pollution that those programs have reduced. School buses were chosen for Project Green Fleet because they represent a significant portion of the diesel vehicles that operate in close proximity to people, and their emissions directly affect the young, sensitive lungs of children. So it was a very good use of our efforts at that time. These projects went on for several years, and then in 2012, a subcommittee of Clean Air Minnesota got together and recommended that there would be actions that would be beneficial in reducing these non-point sources, significant in reducing fine particles and volatile organic compounds. Using these recommendations, in 2013, the MPCA went to the legislature and requested funding to start some of these projects as pilot projects in several of these recommended areas. That was in 2013. We started the process. We're about 1 year in right now. We've designed the process to take about 2 years to implement selected measures of those 24 recommendations that the Clean Air Minnesota group came up with. Now what I'd like to do is summarize several of the projects that we're working on and the PCA's involvement in them. So we have one project that's small business grants, and these small business grants are intended to reduce volatile organic compounds at these small businesses. We're working with the Minnesota Technical Assistance Program on this project, and it's focused on small businesses such as print shops, auto body shops, shops that have the use of a lot of these volatile organic compounds. What the grants are intended to do is implement ways of reducing either the products that they use by replacing them with different products that have less VOC emissions, maybe at water-based solutions and cleaners. And it's also intended to increase efficiency of equipment in ways, like, for instance, if you had an auto body shop that uses a spray gun, if there would be maybe equipment guns that had less overspray, if there would be processes. One of the things they're looking at is there's training that can be done to painters that has less overspray and has less emissions from that process. Another thing could be hoods that increase capture efficiency. Anything that we could do in these grants to help these small businesses reduce their VOC emissions. Vehicle emissions are also a large source, as you saw in that earlier chart. High-emitting vehicles are a problem that we want to deal with. A well-vetted Kansas City study found that 5% of gasoline vehicles were responsible for emitting 30% of the total pollution. So there are certain clunkers, high-emitting vehicles, that with either missing or improperly functioning pollution control equipment are emitting a pretty significant source or a significant percentage of vehicle emissions. What we're doing is we're working with two nonprofit groups, the Lyft Garage and Free to Be, to enhance their programs to also address emissions control equipment. These groups are really, they work with low-income families to get vehicles running and running safely. Their goal is not to reduce emissions. What we're trying to do is enhance their existing programs to test for emissions and then work on some of the things that could significantly reduce emissions from these high-emitting vehicles, like catalytic converters, oxygen sensors, and things like that. There's a couple benefits. There's already existing programs we can work with that already focus on areas where we'd really like to see these improvements. And fuel efficiency could be raised in vehicles as well. So it's just kind of a win-win if we can help support some of these pre-existing programs. Related to diesel vehicles, we have several diesel vehicle emission projects. One is a pilot project that we'd like to work on with some local businesses to reduce idling at warehouses and trucking areas. We've seen some benefits in other parts of the country where groups have worked on programs with, like, let's say, a supermarket warehouse or whatever, to implement a program to limit idling. This would have the benefit of reducing emissions from idling, but also we're thinking we can get kind of buy-in from the company as well, because there would be fuel savings costs that we would see as well that the business would gain. We also have the other two diesel retrofit programs I had mentioned. The Environment Initiative is heading the Project Green Fleet. That's kind of winding down now, since most of the vehicles have, most of the buses have been retrofitted. But the MPCA also works with the EPA to grant money to clean up diesel exhaust by replacing engines, retrofitting engines with pollution control equipment, and sometimes even replacing dirty or older diesel vehicles as well. Another thing that we're working on with diesel vehicles is a Public Works model contract. And we're working with MnDOT on this. And what this is this is kind of a model contract to, in a contract, require that the contractor working with the state or the county or whoever uses a cleaner burning, cleaner operating vehicles, and especially in areas where there's higher density populations. So what we would like to do is work with MnDOT to come up with this model contract that could then be used for counties in contracting with their diesel, the people that use diesel equipment on some of their road and construction projects. Electric vehicle infrastructure. We have a couple of vehicle infrastructure projects working with Drive Electric Minnesota to have charging stations installed in businesses, in public places, in parks, different areas, to set up that infrastructure for electric vehicles to make them easier to use throughout the metro area and easier to use throughout the state. There's also alternative fuel infrastructure work that's being done by the American Lung Association in working with promoting E85, biodiesel, and cleaner burning fuels throughout the state. Wood smoke is another one of our large focus areas. If you look at this picture, the one on the left shows what's called a hydronic heater, or an outdoor wood boiler. What that does is that's a wood-fired device that heats water that's then piped to a residence that's used, or a business that's used, to heat the structure. Part of the problem with these units is that they burn at a very low temperature, and they can be a very smoky burn, causing a lot of particulate matter, fine particulate matter, and volatile organic compounds, and being very annoying to neighbors as well. One of the things that we're doing is we're developing a model ordinance to deal with these units. The Pollution Control Agency doesn't really have the authority, the direct authority, to regulate these units. That's more dealt with by counties, townships, smaller units of government that do not have the ability to come up with ordinances very easily. So what we're doing is we're developing a model ordinance so that it can be easily adopted by townships and counties to regulate these sources. It's a way that we don't have direct regulatory authority over them, but we can aid the groups that actually do have regulatory authority in those areas. We also have a wood smoke outreach program. Backyard fires, fireplaces, wood stoves, they're all significant sources of fine particles and volatile organic compounds. That message coming from all of our Clean Air Minnesota partners together is heard much better, and it's accepted much better by the general public than if it was just one of us saying backyard fires or smoky backyard fires could be dealt with better. It really is a way that we can utilize the voice of all of the members of Clean Air Minnesota to get that message out, to burn clean, dry wood, to limit the amount of fires, to just burn wood in a more effective manner, or limit the burning of wood. There's several other programs that we're working on. We have an urban forestry program. The counties of Hennepin and Ramsey counties are investigating the effects of the loss of tree canopy to the urban heat island, how that affects air conditioning usage, increased power usage, and things. And the Pollution Control Agency actually has a Pew grant to study the effect of the emerald ash borer in the city of St. Paul and its effect on the urban tree canopy as well. We have a Green Corps expansion project where it's an outreach program with local governments and nonprofits, community-based organizations, to increase energy efficiency at their buildings, reduce vehicle miles traveled, such as that. It's an outreach program. And then we also have an air alert outreach program. On days when the air quality is poor or suspected of being poor, what we're trying to do is work with companies to get the word out to their employees and work with just the general public to get the word out that because of environmental effects and because of other things, that the air quality is at risk of being poor, and we like to suggest ways to limit everybody's contribution to the non-point air pollution. So maybe carpooling, limiting lawn mowing if it's a very bad air quality day, limiting backyard fires, things of that nature, so that all the contributions of these non-point sources don't add up to be even worse air quality day. So the next steps for the groups are, like I said, this is the first year of the two-year process. We're ending now. We've designed a lot of these programs. What we're doing now is getting them implemented. And one of the things that we're doing is we're making sure that as we design these programs and as we work with these, we're figuring out ways that we can quantify the reductions that we're achieving in these programs. We feel this is very important so that at the end of our two-year process, we can analyze what we've done, say the amount of money, the amount of effort these programs took, and can really see the actual reduction in pollution that we've gotten from them so that we can then determine how best to proceed in the future. my contact information is here, and Environmental Initiative is the group that's organizing Clean Air Minnesota as far as the website and disseminating the information that it has. The website at the bottom is Environmental Initiative's website. They have updates every month on what the monthly activities of the groups are, the group is, and where we're at in all the different projects we're working on. So if there's any questions about Clean Air Minnesota or our activity, I'd like to take them.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Commissioner Riddle.
Yeah, I was in California this winter and saw the, you know, vehicle emission inspection stations everywhere, the smog check, which I'm not sure exactly the state laws, but my understanding is mandatory, and I don't know if it's annual check or, you know, but I'm just wondering, you know, with this voluntary, you know, non-point system that you described here, any comments on the effectiveness compared to a mandatory vehicle, you know, emissions check on a regular basis?
Madam Chair, Commissioner, the mandatory things are kind of where it seems to go if the voluntary programs don't work. So as far as the effectiveness, I mean, we had a vehicle inspection program in the past. What we're trying to do now is get these voluntary programs going so we don't really have to go to that point. But I don't really know what, you know, the tons of pollution reduced per dollar spent on those are compared to this. But that hopefully that's we can have information after this two-year process to compare that to.
Okay. Commissioner Sampson.
Okay. Good morning. Thank you very much. Just had a question about whether there's a vehicle for citizens outside of the partnership groups to provide input, either, you know, hey, can our neighborhood group help, or we've noticed an issue in this particular neighborhood on these particular days, or maybe, you know, both, you know, on both sides, either helping or pointing out potential opportunities or problems that would be useful to tackle.
Madam Chair, Board Member, we have public input times at the monthly Clean Air Minnesota meetings, but I believe that would be something that if a public group would want to contact us, we could try to get them more involved in some of the work groups related to the area they would be concerned with. We have different work groups that are working on urban air quality, working on the vehicle programs, working on different parts. And that would be a good way to get hold of them to make sure that their voice is heard.
And maybe this is a little bit outside of the scope of this conversation, but we've had conversations in the past about environmental justice. So are there particular, does this group have any sort of goal, or either formal or informal, to reach out to some of the areas that we have perhaps been disproportionately affected by air pollution, their neighborhoods?
Madam Chair, Board Member, yes, that's actually one of the significant things we're looking at when we're quantifying these and when we're looking at where should we focus our areas is dealing with that environmental justice issue. So it's part of how we're determining where we focus on and what we're working on. So yes, it's a significant portion of what we're looking at.
Madam Chair, Mr. Timberson, seems that a large focus of your efforts are in the transportation sector, and so I had a couple of questions because you've talked about diesel and electrical vehicles, or electric vehicles, I should say, but have you done anything in the compressed natural gas in that field at all?
Madam Chair, yeah, the American Lung Association is working on that as well as part of their alternative fuels infrastructure. They're promoting any of the compressed natural gas and stuff. But we're looking at anything in the range of vehicle travel that would be less polluting than gasoline. So that has not risen as one of the major areas we're looking at just because there isn't a great infrastructure for that, but we are looking at it. And the American Lung Association is promoting that as well.
I was just going to mention, I know St. Cloud is the transit system converting to 100% CNG fuel vehicles up there. It'd be a good opportunity to look into that. And then the second question I had, your fourth slide showed some of the air quality standards around the state, but there's nothing in there regarding the metro area.
Madam Chair, it's kind of a really long, complicated way to deal with this. But what we look at is, if you look at the Blaine site, the first bar on the left-hand side, that's just north of the metro area. And that's a very good representation of what ozone is in the metro area, because that's where kind of the ozone generally drifts up to. That's where that level is. So we don't have anything right downtown as a measurement, because we really feel that the best descriptor of what is going on in the metro area actually is represented by Blaine, by that northern metro site.
Okay, thank you.
Dr. Foley?
So what triggers, from a federal standpoint, we become an ozone non-attainment area like we were a few years ago, and when we were in a non-attainment area, then we have vehicle emissions programs places where we had to go to actually get our car tested. Is that in our immediate future if they change the standard?
Madam Chair, yeah. If, let's say the standard's changed, let's say EPA revises the standard and says the new limit is 65 parts per billion, okay? So that would mean Blaine, Cedar Creek, Marshall would be close, but there would be areas that are in non-attainment. So then what the Pollution Control Agency would have to do is develop a state implementation plan to say how we are then going to come into attainment or get below that 65 part per billion level. So then we'd have to come up with things. We'd have to say more restrictions on businesses, vehicle inspection, whatever. That's when we'd have to develop that plan.
Madam Chairman, so that's what happened the last time when Duluth, St. Cloud, and the Twin Cities were in the, we designated them as non-attainment, and those were the three cities, if you lived within their jurisdiction, you had to get your cars tested.
Madam Chair, correct.
Madam Chairman, what about diesel formulation, low sulfur diesel, et cetera, that's being produced by Flint Hills? Do we have a different diesel formulation in Minnesota than they do in Southern California? Do you know that?
Madam Chair, Board Member Foley. No, I believe we don't have the same formulation.
All right, that was a no. I always thought that the reason that trucks ran their cars and ran their engines in the wintertime had to do with diesel fuel actually gelling. And so the diesel is able to stay active, and it's much easier for them to then keep the truck moving if they keep it going and they don't use a lot of fuel. So is there something to that? Is that one of the reasons why you always see these trucks on?
Madam Chair, Board Member Foley, as far as I understand, there's several reasons. One of them is if Let's say you're at a truck stop. There may be somebody that's actually staying in that vehicle overnight, so they would want to stay warm or whatever. There's things that they have called auxiliary power units, mm-hmm. that it's a smaller diesel engine attached to the unit that then can operate to keep the climate reasonable inside the cab. I think actually Mark Salzbeck is in my unit, and I think he deals with diesel much more than I do. He may be able to answer this a little bit better.
So my question, Madam Chairman, really is how much does, idling of diesel vehicles actually contribute to air quality emissions, et cetera?
Can you please introduce yourself to the board?
Madam Chair, board members, Mark Salzbeck, Clean Diesel Grants Manager in Brian's unit. I wanted to mention that large diesel trucks at idle burn about a gallon an hour. So they do have significant emissions at idle. Is there another question?
Member Jensen?
Maybe I can wade in on this a little bit. In the winter, traditionally what you do is you move to a different grade of diesel. You move to a number one, which is a cleaner burning diesel, I believe, as opposed to number two, which is burned in the summertime. And also, I know in the transit industry, we're obligated to burn biodiesel, and that actually contributes to a cleaner burn in the summertime, but it does add to the gelling of the diesel fuel in the wintertime. So rather than I believe it's 20%. I'm not sure. We've moved down to a 5% blend in the wintertime. But all of the transit industry is now under the mandate for the clean diesel, which supports Flint Hill Resources, I guess. But it's that's the regulation. Now we all have to buy the clean diesel engines.
And then I just had one comment, which is in greater Minnesota, last winter we had something of a crisis around delivered fuels. So I think that probably propane and delivered fuels were at a premium with the amount of cold weather and the other issues that were developing. But that probably contributed some to increase in wood burning. But I know that there's a small University of Minnesota research going on about taking those wood boilers that you showed and putting a solar hot water heater into that envelope so that you're actually reducing the amount of wood that needs to be burned because you're drawing upon more solar energy. So there'll be some more results coming out. It might be a strategy, especially if people, part of the environmental justice is keeping houses heated in areas where they're not necessarily on a natural gas line and have to have delivered fuels, which I think is part of that issue as well. So. Any other questions or comments? Okay, thank you very much. Now, we have the water quality. Okay, all right. I will be hearing from Shannon Lotthammer and Kathy O'Dell on the 2013 Triennial Water Quality Standards Review. So an overview of the process and results will be provided.
My name is Shannon Lotthammer. I'm the Director of the Environmental Analysis and Outcomes Division at the Pollution Control Agency, which includes our standards development work both for air quality standards and water quality standards as well. And with me is Kathy O'Dell, who is the coordinator of our Triennial Standards Review work. And we're here to talk about that Triennial Standards Review, which is an important aspect of our water quality standards, which themselves are really a foundational element of all of our water quality programs. So the Water Quality Standards Triennial, or I should back up a moment. Water Quality Standards development is an ongoing process where we're continually developing and adopting revisions to the state's water quality standards to reflect new scientific understandings and also new priorities about concerns about particular chemicals or the need to protect specific beneficial uses of the state's waters. This is an important topic for the board, both because it's a foundational activity of the Pollution Control Agency's water quality program work, and also because the board is called upon to adopt rules where a hearing is required, and that is usually the case with water quality standards changes. So every 3 years, as a part of this process, the PCA reviews its water quality standards for needed revisions and additions and amendments, and this is a requirement of the Clean Water Act. And a really important part of this review is the opportunity for public comment and input to provide information about needed changes to water quality standards and also priorities in standards development work. So the triennial standards review allows us to formally communicate with interested parties about the progress we're making in addressing standards needs and also to discuss and prioritize new development efforts. The process of developing and adopting water quality standards really involves six general steps that you'll see on the slide here. And today's presentation is primarily about identifying and prioritizing the need around water quality standards. This presentation also will help set the stage for future board considerations of rules for adoption, the fifth step in this list. For example, we anticipate that we'll be bringing the river eutrophication and total suspended solid standards to the board for formal approval in the very near future. Before we get into the prioritization of our future efforts, however, and also in anticipation of future board decision items, we thought it might be useful to briefly review what water quality standards are all about. So this is actually going to be a recap of a presentation that the board heard last fall about water quality standards. I know some of you are new board members, and it may be a useful kind of reminder for those of you who have been through this before. But again, standards are a fundamental tool of the Clean Water Act and also of Minnesota's water quality protection and restoration programs. They really get at that goal of the Clean Water Act of restoring and maintaining the physical, chemical, and biological integrity of our nation's waters, and also the interim Clean Water Act goal of fishable and swimmable waters. When we talk about water quality standards, they really come down to three key questions that are being answered through this process. The first is, what and who are we protecting from the impacts of pollution? The second then is, what conditions are protective? And then the third aspect of water quality standards is, how do we maintain high water quality, so better than the minimum needed to be protective? How do we maintain that as much as possible? So the first question, and I believe the most foundational question in water quality standards, is who and what is protected? And this is really kind of the public policy aspect of water quality standards, where water bodies are assigned beneficial uses. This is a requirement of states that comes out of the Clean Water Act. And when you look at both the Federal Clean Water Act and look at state statutes, you can see in the guidance that's provided for setting beneficial uses that the concept of public value really comes into play in setting these beneficial uses. So you see language like best usage in the interest of the public, or use and value for public water supplies and other public uses. So it's very important, if we're going to talk about what's protective, to first know what it is that we're protecting for. And that's really where this use piece comes into play. In Minnesota's water quality rules, we actually have seven beneficial use classifications that have been established and then assigned to Minnesota's lakes, streams, and wetlands. And you can see what all of those use classifications are. And again, they really reflect the desires and values of Minnesotans for how we'd like to use our water bodies and what we'd like them protected for. Most of our waters have multiple uses, so they may be protected for aquatic life and recreation, which is really that fishable, swimmable goal from the Clean Water Act. And then they'll also be protected for industrial uses or aesthetics and navigation. And then some water bodies are also protected as drinking water sources. And then we also have a Class 7 limited resource value water classification in our rules, which really generally apply to water bodies that have very limited habitat for aquatic life. So they may be fully concreted, or they may have riprap. And so the habitat is limited, but that doesn't mean that things aren't able to live there. And they also need to be protected for downstream uses as well, so that a limited resource value water isn't providing an impact downstream. So once we know that what we're protecting for, then really the environmental science piece comes into play. And then the next step is to describe what conditions are protective. And this is the piece that's typically thought of when we think of water quality standards. This is where we get into the number or the description of what needs to be in the water or what needs to stay out of the water in order to fully support that beneficial use. So our water quality standards can be descriptive. So it can be a statement like no undesirable slime growth. Or they can be numeric, like there cannot be more than 6.9 nanograms per liter of mercury in the water in order to protect to protect people who want to eat the fish or wildlife that want to eat the fish. And then there can also be water quality standards that are there can't be less than this. So for our oxygen standards, for example, there needs to be at least 5 milligrams per liter of oxygen in the water, or the fish start to not do so well, and we start to see problems with our fisheries. The other thing about water quality standards is they can be statewide or they can be region-specific as well. And as we get more data and information and better understand our environmental science, we see that there's a tendency towards more regional-specific water quality standards to really reflect the differences that occur across the state. So, for example, when we come before the board in the near future with the total suspended solids and river eutrophication standards, you'll notice that those standards vary based on where you are in the state to really reflect the geological differences, the climate differences that then affect the water quality in those parts of the state as well. So then the third piece of water quality standards, we talked about the beneficial uses, what we're protecting for, we talked about what conditions are protective, and then there's also an element of water quality standards that gets into what do we do if we have water quality that's better than the minimum that's needed to fully support those beneficial uses. And that's where the concept of non-degradation, or another terminology is anti-degradation, comes into play. And this is actually a key protection tool that's built into water quality standards. And it's really focused on providing three different tiers of protection to our lakes, streams, and wetlands. The first is that we need to maintain the existing beneficial uses of our lakes, streams, and wetlands, whether they're specifically identified in our water quality standards rule or not. If a water body has attained a beneficial use and that's been demonstrated, then that beneficial use needs to be maintained. And that's where if that beneficial use isn't fully supported, that's where we get impaired waters. That's where that concept comes from, is the water body is not fully supporting its use, and therefore actions need to be taken in order to fully restore that use. Then the second tier, if you will, within our non-degradation provision of our standards involves protecting high water quality. So this is the situation where the water quality is better than the minimum that's needed to fully support the beneficial use. So there's some capacity there, possibly, to use up some of that water quality and still maintain that beneficial use. And what the Clean Water Act and Minnesota rules provide is that there's a process for reviewing a proposal that would use up some of that existing water quality to see if, first of all, that impact can be avoided or minimized. And then if it can't be avoided or minimized, is there kind of a countervailing social or economic benefit of that use of water quality that really kind of accounts for then the lowering of the water quality that would be a part of that project? And again, in no way, shape, or form can the water quality be impacted to the point where those beneficial uses aren't being fully supported. And then the third piece of the non-degradation standards provisions is that we have waters that are specifically identified in our water quality standards rules as outstanding resource value waters. And these are afforded additional protection beyond those given to all the waters of the state. And these may be outstanding resource value waters because they are particularly pristine, but they may be protected because they have specific cultural value or because they're very rare, like a calcareous fen. So that's kind of the third component of anti-degradation or non-degradation protection that's built into our water quality standards. So just in summary on the overview of water quality standards, if you don't remember anything from this presentation, just remember that it all goes back to the beneficial uses. That's the most foundational piece. And that then the protections that come from that are based on kind of that integration of our understanding of the science and how that relates to the values and the uses that we're trying to protect. Again, they're required by Minnesota statutes and by the Clean Water Act, and there's those three components that really go into water quality standards. Another provision of the Clean Water Act, then, is that water quality standards need to be reviewed on a regular basis, because if you think about it, we've got the public value piece, and then we've also got the environmental science piece, and the value pieces may require ongoing discussion. Certainly the environmental science changes over time, and there's new information that comes to bear. So under the Clean Water Act, there is a requirement that states regularly review their water quality standards and make changes to them based on new information, new science that's available. And the rest of the presentation will really focus on our most recent review of our available information. And this is what we call the triennial standards review. Triennial because it's required every 3 years, and then reviewing our standards to see what new information is available, what changes might be needed, or what new standards might be needed to fully protect those beneficial uses. So this slide just gives kind of an overview of the steps within the triennial standards review. You'll notice that there's the ongoing piece that has to do with technical development of water quality standards and the formal rulemaking that comes out of that. And then the triennial standards review is really those two pieces at the front that provide a regular opportunity for the public to comment on the need for updates and revisions to our water quality standards, whether that's identifying particular pollutants of concern or clarifying the application of the standards or the processes that are built into our rules, or providing information about particular water bodies that maybe need changes in their use classifications to make sure that we're appropriately supporting the beneficial use of those water bodies. So the first step in the triennial standards review is a public comment process. And in this most recent review, that actually started on November 12th of 2013 and then extended to January 28th, 2014. So it's a formal public comment process that gets published in the State Register and then also sent out to everybody that's requested information about our water quality standards. And essentially, we're asking for their feedback about what they think is working well or not working so well in the water quality standards that are in effect in Minnesota. We also held a public meeting that was held on December 11th, and it was held here in St. Paul and then also on webcast for those who weren't able to attend in person. So all of the aspects of Minnesota's water quality standards were open for public comment. And as noted here, the Pollution Control Agency requested feedback on specific parts of our water quality standards that our team really identified as being likely areas for revisions, either because we knew that there was new information that EPA had available, or we knew that there was a lot of interest in a particular area. We actually received 30 comment letters, and we also received a letter from the Environmental Protection Agency, Region 5 out of Chicago. And all of those comment letters are posted on the Pollution Control Agency's website, and I believe that Deputy Commissioner Michelle Beeman has sent out that link to the board members if you're interested in taking a look at those. A few of the highlights of those comments are that we received actually the most comments by far about the chloride water quality standard to protect aquatic life. And the dominant theme amongst those comments was the concern that some have about the potential impacts of implementing that standard to municipalities and to wastewater treatment systems. There's also some additional information that is being put together around the chloride water quality standards. So there's definitely a real interest in reflecting that new information in our state's chloride standard. We also received several letters with similar concerns about implementation related to the adoption of a nitrate water quality standard. We don't currently have a nitrate standard to protect aquatic life. There is one to protect drinking water, but the Pollution Control Agency has been working to develop such a standard, and that was a priority that was identified in the past that's been carried forward. We received a number of letters that expressed concern about potential mining activities and had questions about the adequacy of Minnesota's water quality standards to protect human health and aquatic life from mining impacts. And in particular, we received some letters requesting that we revise our water quality standards to develop aquatic life standards focused on specific conductance, hardness, and total dissolved solids, which are three parameters that have been of recent interest and concern regarding water, the protection of aquatic life. Then we had some letters regarding our copper standard, our selenium standard, and our zinc standard. So if you're interested in all of the details, you can take a look at those on our website. The next step in the process then was really setting priorities for what specific standards the Pollution Control Agency will work on during the next 3 years, and then also how we integrate that with the work that's already underway. So when we do that, we really consider a number of factors. First of all, we look at all of those public comments and consider them very carefully as a part of that prioritization process. We also look at feedback from our own internal program areas to see what areas maybe our standard or our permitting development group or our monitoring group is most in need of when it comes to developing water quality standards. We look at the availability of new science. There may be a lot of interest in a particular contaminant or pollutant or chemical, but there may not be a lot of science available yet to provide the underpinnings for developing that standard. So that's something that we factor in. And then also EPA periodically will request that the states update their standards in a particular way. So we factor that into the prioritization process. And also look at the relative impacts of the various needs that we have. So, for example, if we have a water quality standard that maybe just impacts a few water bodies or has a small reach or maybe only affects a few permits, and that compared to a standards need that maybe is more widespread need or maybe involves many more permits, we'll look at that relative importance, if you will, in setting the parameters. It doesn't mean that both of them aren't important, but as far as allocating limited resources and time, we certainly take that into account. And then, of course, the staff resources are a part of that as well. Since we have certain expertise that's available on our own staff and then that we have access to through the Federal Environmental Protection Agency, we really need to take that into account when we're thinking about what is our plan for the next 3 years and how are we staging the work that we have around water quality standards. So in this most recent triennial review, then, we took all of that information, put it all together, and came up with our list of kind of the things that we're looking to work on over the next 3 years and likely beyond for some of these. And we really put these into kind of three groupings. And the first grouping includes chloride and nitrate. And these were priorities in the last triennial review, which happened in 2008. But since then, the Environmental Protection Agency has been doing some additional toxicity testing. So rather than move forward with those in the near term, in the last couple of years, we've really been waiting for that additional information from EPA so we can incorporate the most up-to-date science into the standards development process. So as soon as that information is available, we will be restarting the more specific work on both chloride and nitrate and moving those more towards the formal rulemaking process. At the same time, EPA has updated the science regarding ammonia toxicity. And given that ammonia and nitrate are just different forms of the same chemical of nitrogen, we think it makes sense to bring in those ammonia changes at the same time that we'd be considering the nitrate changes. So we can talk about nitrogen more as a whole and really put that information together in a more comprehensive way. We also know that revisions to our standards for industrial, agriculture, and wildlife uses are really overdue. These are standards that were adopted often in the 70s. They haven't necessarily received an update since then. It's one of those things that as we've compared priorities, the Class 3 and 4 standards as they're known, which is the standards for industrial, agriculture, and wildlife, haven't always kind of came out as highly compared to the needs for aquatic life, for example, or for human health. But it really is time to take a good look at those standards and make updates as we need to. As a part of that, we do know that some stakeholders and also EPA are concerned that making revisions to these standards might have some unintended consequences or some effects on aquatic life protection for some of the parameters that are included in the Class 3 and 4 standards. So we're going to be considering those concerns as we're addressing the Class 3 and 4 revisions. So we make sure that we keep an eye on the interrelationship between our protections for the various use classes. And then also sulfate has been a chemical of concern for a number of reasons, and we're continuing our work on that, most specifically with digesting and working through the information from the Wild Rice Standards Study focused on sulfates, and that is also part of our ongoing standards work going forward. So in the second group, then, are our revisions to our drinking water use classification. And there's really a need to clarify our application of water quality standards to drinking water, particularly as we look at the interplay between the Clean Water Act and the Safe Drinking Water Act, and then also the interplay between Clean Water Act protections and the Groundwater Protection Act that's in Minnesota statutes. So we've identified some needs and opportunities to really clarify some of that through our rulemaking. Then we're in the process of updating our human health methodologies, so the process that we go through and the steps that we take to calculate a human health standard. That's a rulemaking that's underway that the board will be seeing in the relatively near future, hopefully within the next 3 to 6 months. But then once that part is done, once we have the methods updated, then we need to apply those methods to specific contaminants. And that's part of the work that we're envisioning, at least getting started on that work in the next 3 years. But the first step is really to prioritize which contaminants we need to update sooner rather than later. And that's part of why that's in the second tier of work to be done. And then we've had several requests to update our copper standard to apply some new information that's available. And the EPA has set a priority for updating the bacteria standard that is to base it on some significantly new and improved and broader science that EPA has developed at the national level. Then the third kind of grouping looks at our updating our standards based on new information that's available for cadmium, and then also the need to look at our outstanding resource value waters to see if there's any changes that are needed there, and also to review the limited resource value water classifications to see if there's any changes needed there as well. So that really comprises our list of activities over the next 3 years regarding to new standards development or update needs. But what you may have noticed in the previous slide is that the highest priority standards, when you look at actually the estimated start date, the highest priority standards aren't necessarily the standards that are identified with the first start date. And this next slide really attempts to illustrate why. Because if you remember back to the earlier part of the presentation, to adopt a water quality standard, we need the scientific information that really provides the underpinning for that water quality standard. And in some cases, while something may be a higher priority work on, we may need more time to actually develop that scientific underpinning before we're ready to go to move into more formal rulemaking. Or, for example, in the case of chloride and nitrate, there may be some work happening in other states or at the federal level, and we need to wait until that information is available, or we've decided to wait until that information is available, rather than running the risk of moving forward with the information we have now, and then just as we're adopting the standard, having additional information available, and then maybe needing to go right back into rulemaking again in order to incorporate that new information. So while a standard may be the highest priority, it may not be the first thing that we work on because of these different factors that come into play. And of course, as we're working on the standards work over the next couple of years, things can change as well and the priorities can shift. And maybe that new information comes to bear that we weren't aware was going to come out, so a new academic study or new work by another state that's wrestling with a particular problem. It could be that there are needs associated with implementation questions that are coming up, and that takes up some time, and so we need to adjust our schedule because of that. So as this slide alludes to, and also the previous slide, the standards development that's underway continuously. And what the triennial review does is it really helps set those priorities every 3 years, but those priorities really need to be integrated into the work that's already underway. So just as a reminder, some of the things that we do have underway, again, is our river eutrophication and total suspended solids standards development, and that is the first group of specific standards that is likely to come before the board for final approval in the next month or two. I mentioned the human health revisions. That's kind of the next group that we've been working on to really incorporate that human health methodology. And then, for example, the wild rice and sulfate work, we're continuing to digest and analyze the study results. And then in that case, we'll be moving into a formal peer review process because that work hasn't gone through the scientific journal publishing effort. So we want to get that formal peer review before we make any proposals or determinations about standards development regarding that. We also have other related work that isn't necessarily adopting a particular standard, but is certainly part of the work that our standards group does in implementing our water quality standards. So, for example, we have a variance rule that is about making departures to our water quality standards in certain situations. And that rule is in need of some updates to make it more consistent with the EPA approach and more consistent internally within our rules. So we're looking at that effort. There's also provisions for setting site-specific standards where we have water bodies that maybe have a little different situation, and therefore the way that pollutants react within that water body is more specific to that water body than to kind of the rest of Minnesota lakes or streams or wetlands. We're always working to clarify the application of water quality standards and to work with our program areas and with interested stakeholders in implementing those standards. And then one of the things that we've taken on as a much more concerted effort over the last couple of years is communicating about our water quality standards and really moving beyond just focusing on that number to really talking about what that means and what is the beneficial use that that's intended to protect and what are the implications of that, whether it's for setting the goals for the pollution diets that are a part of total maximum daily loads or implementing those water quality standards through our permits and other practices. So again, all of these efforts together make up really the full portfolio of the Pollution Control Agency's water quality standards development work. And I should point out that as individual standards move into formal rulemaking, there are significant public comment opportunities that are a part of that process as we follow the Administrative Procedures Act and go through formal public comment. And typically there's a hearing that's associated with that and formal response to comments. And so the unique thing about the Triennial Standards Review is that really provides us with a systems-level view of our standards development work and allows us to communicate with the public about that work as a whole and get their input and dialogue about that work. And that way we're not only focusing on specific standards, but really focusing on the activities as a whole as a part of this important component of protecting and restoring water quality. So this Triennial Standards Review actually began in 2013, and we're now wrapping it up with this presentation and moving forward with our priority efforts. So the next one will begin in 2016, where we'll go through the process again and get that feedback. And in the meantime, we are going to be developing an interim report so we can share the progress and communicate about any changes in the priorities and really give a more formal update on the work that we're doing. And of course, we continually keep information available on our website. So if board members or the interested public or stakeholders want to see what's happening at any given moment, they can go to our website or subscribe to our Gov delivery list and really get even more frequent updates on what's happening with water quality standards development at the PCA. So again, thank you for the opportunity to provide this information about our water quality standards and the Triennial Standards Review effort. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Member Jensen.
Question: when you establish the standard and you determine the water quality in a particular body.
Chairman, when you establish a standard and you determine there's an impairment for whatever reason in a body of water, and then you take action, remedial action to fix that, what becomes the new standard? At what point do you reach a level of satisfaction, and at that point do you establish that it's not the point of success, I guess?
Sure. So, Madam Chair and Board Member Jensen, the way that that works is when the states are required to go out and monitor their lakes, streams, and wetlands to see if those standards are being met. And so when we identify that a standard isn't being met, then we actually go through a process of listing that as impaired on something called the 303D list or the impaired waters list. And that has a public comment process as well. And then there's the work that is done to identify the pollution diet, to figure out, you know, where's the pollution coming from and how much does it need to be reduced in order to achieve the beneficial use again. And the standard, so the number that was originally found to be not being met, really becomes the target for that pollution diet. And then as that's implemented, we go back and monitor, or our local partners monitor, to see if that standard has been met. And once that standard's met and we can identify that, you know, it's been met because of actions taken in the watershed or in the water body, it's not just kind of natural variability, then we propose that to be delisted, and then the standard kind of becomes that target again. So the standard is the target throughout. At the start of the process, the water body isn't meeting that standard, and then as we move through the process, we're moving it to meet the standard so that beneficial use can be fully supported.
But if you achieve a better than expected result, does that become the new standard then, or do you allow it to slip back?
Sure. Madam Chair and Board Member Jensen, that becomes the new standard. So if we achieve a better result, then that essentially becomes the new standard, unless there is an anti-degradation review, that through that review process we determine that because there's a social or economic benefit to a project that's being proposed, that some change to the water quality is allowed. So the standard that's set in rule is kind of the baseline, and that's the line in the sand that you can't go past. In situations where we have better water quality than that better water quality kind of acts as the standard unless an anti-degradation review allows for some change in that, and that goes through a public comment process as well.
Thank you.
Hmm? Board Member Riddle.
Yeah, you talked about the standards for nitrates and ammonia, but you didn't mention anything about agricultural pesticides. And is that a responsibility of the agency to establish and monitor those standards in surface waters?
Madam Chair and Board Member Riddle, yes, the Pollution Control Agency has the responsibility for establishing standards to protect for those beneficial uses. We actually work really closely with the Department of Agriculture because the Department of Agriculture has a pesticide management program, and then also they do a lot of the pesticide monitoring for the state. But when it comes to actually establishing the standards, under the Clean Water Act anyways, that becomes a Pollution Control Agency responsibility. And we do have a couple of standards that are focused on pesticides, typically looking at human health concerns or aquatic life concerns.
Mm-hmm. And when there are emerging pesticide threats, and I'm thinking specifically about research showing that the toxins in the BT corn, which has been, you know, engineered to contain an insecticidal protein in every cell of the plant, and that research is showing that toxin remains biologically active in water, in research in Indiana, and that it's killing caddisfly larvae, which are kind of a keystone species in the aquatic ecosystem, especially for trout food source. How are these emerging pesticidal contaminants that are a whole new class of insecticides that haven't been addressed before? Typically, it's focused on chemical pesticides, but now we have biological. How are those addressed in water quality standards?
Ms. Lefhammer.
Madam Chair and Member Riddle, that's a great question. It's something that folks is a challenge on the national level and also on the state level, particularly because, you know, the methodologies for establishing water quality standards are pretty straightforward, and there's lots of guidance when we're looking at kind of directly toxic issues. But when we get to more of these emerging concerns and also kind of different mechanisms of toxicity, the process is a little less clear. And that's something that I think a number of states and EPA are working on, and our standards folks are keeping apprised of. The other thing that we have going on that I think gets at that maybe a little bit more is, fortunately, in the last biennium, the legislature provided the Pollution Control Agency with funding under the Clean Water Land and Legacy Amendment, so under the constitutional amendment from the Clean Water Fund, to actually establish some screening level work. So an effort to develop screening level benchmarks for some of these contaminants of emerging concern, where the pathway and the process and maybe the body of data needed to develop a standard isn't quite there yet, but we're starting to have information to identify some levels that may be of concern or need further investigation. So we've actually been able to bring on staff an ecotoxicologist that is helping to identify what types of contaminants we need to develop these screening levels for and then to develop them. And that will really help us provide or will give us some more information to help set priorities for standards development in the future. So we're working with the Department of Agriculture and also with the Department of Health on how to kind of go about doing this. The Department of Health has been doing this kind of work for human health criteria for a little while, and so we're modeling our effort after the process that they follow, but we're looking to really focus more on the aquatic life concerns and the ecosystem concerns, and then a little bit on the non-drinking water pathway effects on humans as well. So we don't have it all sorted out yet, but we do have a process in place for working towards getting at the kinds of questions and contaminants that you mentioned.
Dr. Sampson?
Thanks, Director Rothammer. I have a general question for you and then one related to the frac sand mining. First one is, you said it all goes back to the uses, key concept there. Could you talk a little bit about how a body of water is assigned to particular use class and how it might shift from a different to a different class over time?
Sure. So, Madam Chair and Member Sampson, there's actually a couple different ways that, or two different models for assigning beneficial use classes that have been used in the U.S. One is, and this is the approach that Minnesota took, was back in the 60s and 70s when our rules were first being adopted. The agency specifically identified particular water bodies that were listed in our Chapter 7050 as having potential uses, and then any water body that wasn't specifically identified was given a Class 2 beneficial use classification. So, and the concept there, I think, was that, and it's really a concept built into the Clean Water Act, that at a minimum, all of our lakes, streams, and wetlands, to the extent that they support fish and aquatic life, should be swimmable and fishable. That's kind of a baseline value or need or use. So for Minnesota, as we get new information then, that maybe suggests that a use classification needs to be changed, we can go through something that's called a use attainability analysis. And this is if a water body is designated, for example, as aquatic life, supporting aquatic life. And there's a question about, is this water body really able to fully support aquatic life? We can go through a provision called a use attainability analysis to analyze whether the water body ever did support aquatic life from the time when that provision went into the Clean Water Act, or if it has the potential to support aquatic life if just some changes happened to the water body or the watershed so that it was more hospitable to aquatic life. And that's called a use attainability analysis. And if a water body is found that it can't attain that use, either it hasn't ever or it can't in the future, then the next kind of highest use is assigned to the water body. The other way that uses can be changed is, again, getting new information. Or if a water body is designated, for example, as a limited resource value water, and then we go in and monitor the water body and find that it is supporting a pretty healthy aquatic life community, then we go through a process of redesignating that water body to reflect what its current use is now. So it's really data-driven for making changes to use classifications. And as we've been doing more and more monitoring with the resources that are available through the constitutional amendment, we've gotten more information to really help us further refine those use classifications.
Okay, great.
Or better, you, Bob?
In determining water quality standards, excuse me, Madam Chair, Ms. Lothammer, in determining water quality standards, is the agency's analysis limited to chemical or mineral pollutants, or are invasive species considered, or they fall under the purview of the DNR?
Madam Chair and Member Ibarra, we actually have biological criteria as well in our water quality standards. So we look at the diversity. For example, we have biological criteria for fish and macroinvertebrates as kind of indicator communities. And that's for our streams. And so we look at the diversity of the fish and the macroinvertebrates in the streams, and we look at like the number of tolerant species and intolerant species. And to the extent that invasive species cause a disruption in that community structure and in the types of species that we're seeing, the presence of invasive species can then result in an impairment being identified because they disrupt the ecosystem and then they disrupt our indices that where we measure the health of that ecosystem. We can also see that we actually have plant community indices for wetlands as well, where invasive species would come into play there. We don't currently have an approach where just the presence of an invasive species results in a water body being impaired. Instead, we look at what's the health of that aquatic community, and then, you know, often invasive species can disrupt that health and result in an impairment. So.
Thank you.
Dr. Sampson.
Thank you. I have a follow-up question on that. Zebra mussels actually might be a little bit of an outlier because they sometimes increase the clarity. Is that considered if you see an unexpected increase in clarity and there are zebra mussels present and there may be. So in effect, the zebra mussels might be masking some other pollutant. Is that taken into consideration?
Madam Chair and Member Sampson, yeah, we are really trying to look at that kind of information and to integrate that in more fully. There's definitely a lot of discussion at the national level and within Minnesota about how do invasive species play in with water quality kinds of considerations. I think it's most clear when we're talking about biological integrity. It's less clear when we're talking about things like chemical integrity. But we do have a really strong partnership with the Department of Natural Resources, both in, you know, identifying and making note of where there are invasive species so we can consider that. We also work really closely with them just on our standard operating procedures for monitoring to make sure that we know where invasive species are present so that we're not inadvertently spreading them around as we're monitoring across the state. So that's also helped us, I think, be more aware of that and help kind of with that reporting and working through those kinds of questions that are really, really challenging because there are so many different kind of components that play in.
Sure. Thank you.
Board Member Jensen?
I do the same thing.
Monitoring is critical to your program. So could you just give me a brief summary on the mechanics of how the monitoring is done, if it's a combination of volunteers and paid staff, and how frequently? I know you don't run out every 3 years, just in anticipation of the training review and do that. So I know it's an ongoing process, but could you give me some background on that?
Sure. Madam Chair and Member Jensen, I'll focus. We have several different kind of monitoring approaches that we take, but I'll focus on kind of the two that most consistently kind of play into our standards development. The first is that the state has a 10-year cycle by which we monitor all of the major watersheds within the state. So there's 81 major watersheds, so we try to get to about 8 of them every year. It's a 2-year monitoring process. It's actually a combination of state agency staff that do the work and then local partners. Often it's a watershed district or a city or a county that's doing some of the monitoring as well. And there we're looking at the biological community. So for fish or in streams, we're looking at fish and macroinvertebrates. And then we're looking at chemistry as well, both for lakes and streams and doing wetland monitoring as a component of that. And then we also are looking at physical monitoring of looking at flow and how flow and pollution kind of operate together within the watersheds. So that's kind of our 10-year monitoring cycle. That provides the most data and information that we have for looking at where we have problems with water quality standards and where we need to take action to restore or protect water bodies. The other thing that we have is and this is work that's done in cooperation with the Federal Environmental Protection Agency. There's actually a national program of doing what's called statistically based or probabilistic monitoring. And EPA has set up a process whereby every 5 years, on the national level, there's a study that's done of lakes, wadable streams, so smaller streams, larger rivers, wetlands, and then coastal waters. So those five different types of water bodies every 5 years get this study. And what that involves actually is using statistics to figure out how many water bodies and which water bodies to sample. So we can sample a smaller number of water bodies, typically about 50 to 150, depending on what we're looking at across the state. But because they're selected statistically, they're representative of the state as a whole. And what that allows us to do, because there's fewer sites, we can actually get more information. So in that case, instead of focusing just on kind of the pollutants that we have standards for example, or that we think are the most common problems, we can look at things like a huge suite of pesticides or a lot more contaminants of emerging concern or getting more in depth into the habitat or the aquatic environment because we can spend more time since we're going to fewer sites. And that information is really invaluable to both kind of characterizing the state as a whole, but then also providing information about where might we need to follow up, whether it's standards development work or, you know, we're starting to see a consistent contaminant showing up again and again. So maybe we need to move that into our more routine monitoring that's happening using the watershed model. So in those ways, you know, we have different monitoring designs that really kind of get at different information, but then ultimately work together to inform our understanding of the water bodies and then also help inform how we apply the standards too.
Thank you.
Dr. Sampson.
Thanks. I have you and I could chat for hours about this, so, and I think we have, but I had a question. The commissioner's report that Assistant Commissioner Beeman, Deputy Commissioner Beeman gave talked about the funds that have been set aside for the Roseau River and the mercury study there, and you and I have had conversations about the St. Louis River, and those seem to be bodies of water that fall in the rulemaking. They behave differently than others around mercury. Could you comment on how, first of all, maybe just give a thumbnail of how the study's going in the St. Louis River, how you anticipate the new funds will facilitate establishing things for the Roseau, and then sort of how do you deal with these bodies of waters that don't behave like others?
So, Madam Chair and Member Sampson, so for the work that we received LCCMR funding for, basically it's $743,000, and a big part of that will be going towards monitoring the flow of waters and also the concentrations of mercury and methylmercury in the Roseau River and then two tributaries to the Red River to start to get more relative information about mercury loading in these water bodies that have exceptionally high mercury concentrations in their fish. So about 10%, so I should step back a moment. So the state of Minnesota back in the 2000s, kind of mid to late 2000s, actually developed a pollution diet, the total maximum daily load, to address mercury contaminants in fish, or to address mercury contamination of fish, and the fact that we can't eat unlimited amounts of fish because of mercury contamination. And so a large share of that pollution actually comes from out of the state. But to address the share that comes from in the state, we did a statewide mercury TMDL that actually calls for a 90% reduction of the emissions and discharges of mercury from sources within the state, so from our permitted facilities in Minnesota. And we're actually on track to fully meet that goal by 2018. That was the implementation part of that TMDL. But what we knew as a part of that TMDL is that about 10% of our water bodies that are impaired for mercury actually have higher concentrations of mercury in the fish than the rest of the water bodies. So fully implementing the TMDL, both the Minnesota reductions and then what's needed on a global basis, isn't going to fully restore those 10% of the water bodies because they have comparatively higher mercury concentrations in the fish. We think we know the factors that play into that. We think that it has to do with food chain differences. There may be differences in sulfate concentrations. There's a relationship with organic carbon. So there's these different factors that play into how mercury get into the fish. But what we don't know yet for those 10% of water bodies is what's the relative importance of those various factors and which ones can we push on in order to fully restore those water bodies. It tends to be the more pristine, if you will, water bodies that have these higher concentrations in the fish. They have simpler food chains, which may result in the mercury concentrating more heavily. There's a number of things that may play into that. So we actually proposed to the Legislative Citizen Commission on Minnesota Resources for funding to really further investigate these 10% of water bodies and to focus on the rivers that are part of this, because the rivers are the most complicated system. So we can figure out what's going on in the rivers. We think we'll have the information to address the same issue that we're seeing in some of the lakes. One of the rivers was the St. Louis River. Another one was the Red River in the north, the Roseau River, and a couple of others. So for the St. Louis River, we actually have some loading information about the amount of mercury that's coming from the watershed and where the mercury is coming from and where the methyl mercury is coming from. So we wanted to add to that information and then also collect that information for the other rivers. And then in addition to that, do some more detailed food chain studies to look at mercury and methyl mercury concentrations in the macroinvertebrates, so the lower levels of the food chain, and then through the different fish stages of the food chain to see where that mercury is accumulating in the fish, to see if we can pinpoint that. And then also look at how methyl mercury, which is the toxic form that we're concerned about, how that is created, and then also how it's destroyed, how methylation occurs and how demethylation occurs in these water bodies as well. What ended up happening through the LCCMR process is that we received funding to do the loading work on the Roseau and two tributaries. And that comparative information is really important because these water bodies are very different. I mean, if you think about the St. Louis River in the northeast, the Red River in the north and the northwest, they're very different river systems, and yet they both have this issue with elevated mercury in the fish. So getting the comparative information is critical because that may help us figure out, you know, what do they have in common? And what they have in common then might lead us to what are the things that we can push on or affect in order to fully solve this problem. So most of the funding is for the loading work in kind of the northwest part of the state. But as a part of that, we did receive the funds to do the food chain study and the mercury methylation and demethylation work in all of the rivers, including the St. Louis River. So we're very excited about that because really, again, getting that comparative information across all five of the rivers is an important part of teasing out what the issues might be or what the factors might be. In the St. Louis River, we're also working really closely with the Fond du Lac Band and with the state of Wisconsin, and then through kind of a coordination effort of EPA, because we all have a common interest in addressing the mercury issues in the St. Louis River. And so the PCA has been focused on getting the information or doing the research to look at the drivers of the elevated mercury concentrations. The Fond du Lac Band and the state of Wisconsin have been working with EPA to hopefully get some additional funding to look at some things going on in the estuary and also some additional loading information. So we're continuing to look for ways that we can coordinate and cooperate and kind of pool our efforts so that we understand and can address the mercury issues in the St. Louis. But then from Minnesota's perspective, we also want to understand what's happening in those other 10% of the water so we can address this more broadly for Minnesota as a whole. Does that mostly get what you're looking for? Okay.
Do we have any further questions? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. We are on our last item of the agenda. Is there a motion to adjourn this meeting? Okay. Board Member Riddle moves the adjournment of the meeting. Is there a second?
Second.
Okay. Board Member Ibarra seconds the motion. Please signify by saying aye that you support the motion to adjourn the meeting.
Aye.
Any nays? Okay. Meeting is adjourned.